Chapter 46. Lily looked up. The speaker was a poorly dressed young woman with a bundle under her arm. Her face had the air of unwholesome refinement which ill health and overwork may produce, but its common prettiness was redeemed by the strong and generous curve of the lips. "You don't remember me," she continued, brightening with the pleasure of recognition, "but I'd know you anywhere. I've thought of you such a lot. I guess my folks all know your name by heart. I was one of the girls at Miss Farish's club. You helped me to go to the country that time I had lung trouble. My name's Nettie Struther. It was Nettie Crane then, but I dare say you don't remember that either." Yes, Lily was beginning to remember. The episode of Nettie Crane's timely rescue from disease had been one of the most satisfying incidents of her connection with Gertie's charitable work. As he had furnished the girl with the means to go to a sanatorium in the mountains. It struck her now with a peculiar irony that the money as he had used had been Gus Treanor's. She tried to reply, to assure the speaker that as he had not forgotten, but her voice failed in the effort, and she felt herself sinking under a great wave of physical weakness. Nettie Struther, with a startled exclamation, sat down and slipped a shabbily clad arm behind her back. "Why, Miss Bart, you are sick. Just lean on me a little till you feel better." A faint glow of returning strength seemed to pass into Lily from the pressure of the supporting arm. "I'm only tired, it is nothing," she found voice to say in a moment, and then, as she met the timid appeal of her companion's eyes, she added involuntarily, "I have been unhappy in great trouble." "You in trouble? I've always thought of you as being so high up, where everything was just grand. Sometimes, when I felt real mean, and got to wondering why things were so queerly fixed in the world, I used to remember that you were having a lovely time, anyhow, and that seemed to show there was a kind of justice somewhere. But you mustn't sit here too long, it's fearfully damp. Don't you feel strong enough to walk on a little ways now?" she broke off. "Yes, yes, I must go home," Lily murmured, rising. Her eyes rested wonderingly on the thin, shabby figure at her side. As he had known Nettie Crane as one of the discouraged victims of overwork and anemic parentage. One of the superfluous fragments of life destined to be swept prematurely into that social refuse heap, of which Lily had so lately expressed her dread. But Nettie Struther's frail envelope was now alive with hope and energy. Whatever fate the future reserved for her, she would not be cast into the refuse heap without a struggle. "I am very glad to have seen you," Lily continued, summoning a smile to her unsteady lips. "It'll be my turn to think of you as happy, and the world will seem a less unjust place to me too. Oh, but I can't leave you like this. You're not fit to go home alone. And I can't go with you either," Nettie Struther wailed with a start of recollection. "Why, you see, it's my husband's night shift. He's a motor man, and the friend I leave the baby with has to step upstairs to get her husband's supper at 7. I didn't tell you I had a baby, did I? She'll be 4 months old day after tomorrow, and to look at her, you wouldn't think I'd ever had a sick day. I'd give anything to show you the baby, Miss Bart, and we live right down the street here. It's only 3 blocks off." She lifted her eyes tentatively to Lily's face, and then added with a burst of courage, "Why won't you get right into the cars and come home with me while I get baby's supper? It's real warm in our kitchen, and you can rest there, and I'll take you home as soon as ever she drops off to sleep." It was warm in the kitchen, which, when Nettie Struther's match had made a flame leap from the gas jet above the table, revealed itself to Lily as extraordinarily small and almost miraculously clean. A fire shone through the polished flanks of the iron stove, and near it stood a crib in which a baby was sitting upright, with incipient anxiety struggling for expression on a countenance still placid with sleep. Having passionately celebrated a reunion with her offspring, and excused herself in cryptic language for the lateness of her return, Nettie restored the baby to the crib, and shyly invited Miss Bart to the rocking chair near the stove. "We've got a parlor too," she explained with pardonable pride. "But I guess it's warmer in here, and I don't want to leave you alone while I'm getting baby's supper." On receiving Lily's assurance that she much preferred the friendly proximity of the kitchen fire, Mrs. Truther proceeded to prepare a bottle of infantile food, which she tenderly applied to the baby's impatient lips. And while the ensuing degustation went on, she seated herself with a beaming countenance beside her visitor. "You're sure you won't let me warm up a drop of coffee for you, Miss Bart? There's some of baby's fresh milk left over. Well, maybe you'd rather just sit quiet and rest a little while. It's too lovely having you here. I've thought of it so often that I can't believe it's really come true. I've said to George again and again, I just wish Miss Bart could see me now apostrophe, and I used to watch for your name in the papers, and we'd talk over what you were doing, and read the descriptions of the dresses you wore. I haven't seen your name for a long time, though, and I began to be afraid you were sick, and it worried me, so that George said I'd get sick myself, fretting about it." Her lips broke into a reminiscent smile. "Well, I can't afford to be sick again, that's a fact. The last spell nearly finished me. When you sent me off that time I never thought I'd come back alive, and I didn't much care if I did. You see, I didn't know about George and the baby then." She paused to readjust the bottle to the child's bubbling mouth. "You precious, don't you be in too much of a hurry. Was it mad with Mama for getting its supper so late? Mary Antoinette, that's what we call her. After the French queen in that play at the garden, I told George the actress reminded me of you, and that made me fancy the name. I never thought I'd get married, you know, and I'd never have had the heart to go on working just for myself." She broke off again, and meeting the encouragement in Lily's eyes, went on, with a flush rising under her anemic skin, "You see, I wasn't only just sick. That time you sent me off I was dreadfully unhappy too. I'd known a gentleman, where I was employed, I don't know as you remember, I did typewriting in a big importing firm, and well, I thought we were to be married. He'd gone steady with me 6 months, and given me his mother's wedding ring. But I presume he was too stylish for me, he traveled for the firm, and had seen a great deal of society. Work girls aren't looked after the way you are, and they don't always know how to look after themselves. I didn't. And it pretty near killed me when he went away, and left off writing. It was then I came down sick. I thought it was the end of everything. I guess it would have been if you hadn't sent me off. But when I found I was getting well, I began to take heart in spite of myself. And then, when I got back home, George came round, and asked me to marry him. At first I thought I couldn't, because we'd been brought up together, and I knew he knew about me. But after a while I began to see that that made it easier. I never could have told another man, and I'd never have married without telling, but if George cared for me enough to have me as I was, I didn't see why I shouldn't begin over again, and I did." The strength of the victory shone forth from her as she lifted her radiated face from the child on her knees. Mercy, I didn't mean to go on like this about myself, with you sitting there looking so fagged out. Only it's so lovely having you here, and letting you see just how you've helped me." The baby had sunk back blissfully replete, and Mrs. Truther softly rose to lay the bottle aside. Then she paused before Miss Bart. "I only wish I could help you, but I suppose there's nothing on earth I could do," she murmured wistfully. Lily, instead of answering, rose with a smile and held out her arms, and the mother, understanding the gesture, laid her child in them. The baby, feeling herself detached from her habitual anchorage, made an instinctive motion of resistance, but the soothing influences of digestion prevailed, and Lily felt the soft weight sink trustfully against her breast. The child's confidence in its safety thrilled her with a sense of warmth and returning life, and she bent over, wondering at the rosy blur of the little face, the empty clearness of the eyes, the vague tenderly motions of the folding and unfolding fingers. At first the burden in her arms seemed as light as a pink cloud or a heap of down, but as she continued to hold it the waiting crest, sinking deeper, and penetrating her with a strange sense of weakness, as though the child entered into her, and became a part of herself. She looked up, and saw Nettie's eyes resting on her with tenderness and exultation. Wouldn't it be too lovely for anything, if she could grow up to be just like you? Of course I know she never could, but mothers are always dreaming the craziest things for their children. Lily clasped the child close for a moment, and laid her back in her mother's arms. Oh, she must not do that. I should be afraid to come and see her too often, she said with a smile, and then, resisting Mrs. Truther's anxious offer of companionship, and reiterating the promise that of course she would come back soon, and make George's acquaintance, and see the baby in her bath, she passed out of the kitchen, and went alone down the tenement stairs. As she reached the street, she realized that she felt stronger and happier. The little episode had done her good. It was the first time S.E. had ever come across the results of her SPASP 333 greater than modic benevolence, and the surprised sense of human fellowship took the mortal chill from her heart. It was not till she entered her own door that she felt the reaction of a deeper loneliness. It was long after 7 o'clock, and the light and odors proceeding from the basement made it manifest that the boarding house dinner had begun. S.E. hastened up to her room, lit the gas, and began to dress. She did not mean to pamper herself any longer, to go without food, because her surroundings made it unpalatable. Since it was her fate to live in a boarding house, she must learn to fall in with the conditions of the life. Nevertheless, she was glad that, when she descended to the heat and glare of the dining room, the repast was nearly over. In her own room again, she was seized with a sudden fever of activity. For weeks past, S.E. had been too listless and indifferent to set her possessions in order, but now she began to examine systematically the contents of her drawers and cupboard. S.E. had a few handsome dresses left survivals of her last phase of splendor, on the Sabrina and in London, but when S.E. had been obliged to part with her maid, S.E. had given the woman a generous share of her cast-off apparel. The remaining dresses, though they had lost their freshness, still kept the long unerring lines, the sweep and amplitude of the great artist's stroke, and as she spread them out on the bed, the scenes in which they had been worn rose vividly before her. An association lurked in every fold. Each fall of lace and gleam of embroidery was like a letter in the record of her past. She was startled to find how the atmosphere of her old life enveloped her. But, after all, it was the life S.E. had been made for. Every dawning tendency in her had been carefully directed toward it. All her interests and activities had been taught to center around it. She was like some rare flower grown for exhibition, a flower from which every bud had been nipped except the crowning blossom of her beauty. Last of all, she drew forth from the bottom of her trunk a heap of white drapery which fell shapelessly across her arm. It was the Reynolds dress S.E. had worn in the bride tableau. It had been impossible for her to give it away, but S.E. had never seen it since that night, and the long flexible folds, as she shook them out, gave forth an odor of violets which came to her like a breath from the flower-etched fountain, where S.E. had stood with Lawrence Selden and disowned her fate. She put back the dresses one by one, laying away with each some gleam of light, some note of laughter, some stray waft from the rosy shores of pleasure. She was still in a state of highly wrought impressionability, and every hint of the past sent a lingering tremor along her nerves. S.E. had just closed her trunk on the white folds of the Reynolds dress, when she heard a tap at her door, and the red fist of the Irish maid servant thrust in a belated letter. Carrying it to the light, Lily read with surprise the address stamped on the upper cover of the envelope. It was a business communication from the office of Grant's executors, and she wondered what unexpected development had caused them to break silence before the appointed time. She opened the envelope and a check fluttered to the floor. As she stooped to pick it up, the blood rushed to her face. The check represented the full amount of Mrs. Peniston's legacy, and the letter accompanying it explained that the executors, having adjusted the business of the estate with less delay than they had expected, had decided to anticipate the date fixed for the payment of the bequests. Lily sat down beside the desk at the foot of her bed, and spreading out the check, read over and over the $10,000 written across it in a steely business hand. 10 months earlier, the amount it stood for had represented the depths of penury, but her standard of values had changed in the interval, and now visions of wealth lurked in every flourish of the pen. As she continued to gaze at it, she felt the glitter of the visions mounting to her brain, and after a while she lifted the lid of the desk, and slipped the magic formula out of sight. It was easier to think without those five figures dancing before her eyes, and as he had a great deal of thinking to do before she slept. She opened her checkbook, and plunged into such anxious calculations as had prolonged her vigil at Bellomont on the night when S.E. had decided to marry Percy Grice. Poverty simplifies bookkeeping, and her financial situation was easier to ascertain than it had been then. But S.E. had not yet learned the control of money, and during her transient phase of luxury at the Emporium, S.E. had slipped back into habits of extravagance which still impaired her slender balance. A careful examination of her checkbook, and of the unpaid bills in her desk, showed that, when the latter had been settled, she would have barely enough to live on for the next 3 or 4 months. And even after that, if she were to continue her present way of living, without earning any additional money, all incidental expenses must be reduced to the vanishing point. She hid her eyes with a shudder, beholding herself at the entrance of that ever-narrowing perspective down which S.E. had seen Miss Silverton's doughty figure take its despondent way. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.